Hello and welcome to SoftSpot. I'm Chelsea Hamishan, the Global Soft Foundation's Director of Marketing, and I need to first take the blame for the delay in posting a new episode. We were basically on the road or at Sofic for about a month, and although I did bring a mic with me all around Europe and to Sofic, I failed to find the time to actually use it, so I'm sorry for the delay. But I've got a bunch of recordings in the hopper right now, starting with this episode with Congressman Seth Moulton. We recently attended the Future Security Forum in D.C., which was an event hosted by our think tank partner, New America. They were kind enough to allow us to briefly interview their speakers after their presentations, and Congressman Moulton was one of the speakers who generously offered his time. Congressman Moulton is the U.S. representative for the 6th Congressional District of Massachusetts, which he has been since he was elected in 2015. He's also a former Marine Corps officer, and he is currently campaigning for the Democratic nomination for the presidency in 2020. Listen on as we talk to him about his views on the U.S. defense strategy.
And then if we want to break it down...
Global Soft Foundation.
My immediate reaction was, this is awesome.
This
the Special Operations
Community. Association for Special Operations. You have our support. Let's move.
Welcome to SoftSpot.
Well, thank you, Congressman Seth Moulton, for joining us today.
It's an honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
We, with the Global Soft Foundation, we're a professional association for the Special Operations Community. So listening in to your talk just now in the session, you are speaking my language, because we think, too, that the investment is too far in the legacy platforms and not enough in things that are modern warfare, hybrid threats, irregular warfare. So could you expound a little bit on how you see the role of special operations in your national security strategy and platform?
Absolutely. First of all, thank you for having this conversation. And I do think it's incredibly important that we rethink our national defense. I've talked about how we need a totally new generation of arms control, and alliances. And the arms piece is not just about weapon systems, about how many aircraft carriers we have or how much we're investing in cyber or artificial intelligence. It's also about the types of troops that we have and what they're trained to do. And if there's one lesson we've learned from the last few years of the war on terror, it's that special operations forces have a big role to play. In this fight, I also think there's an argument that that even our traditional line troops need to learn more of the special operations types of training tactics and techniques that have made them successful. So, in other words, it used to be the Green Berets that just specialized in understanding foreign cultures and working with foreign militaries. But now that's something that all of our troops are expected to do when they deploy to places like Africa or Afghanistan or Iraq. So there are a lot of lessons to be learned and a lot of capabilities that we need to double down on in the special operations community.
Do you think that we talked a lot about cyber in the last session, too? And as you were speaking, it struck me, is cyber something that, you know, every soldier now should really be familiar with and trained in?
Absolutely. It's something that everybody has to recognize is a threat. It's literally how we get attacked every single day by our greatest adversaries, by Russia and China, not to mention many other adversaries like North Korea, for example, who's been very successful, remarkably successful at conducting cyber attacks against the United States. So we're woefully unprepared as a country. It means that every soldier, sailor, Marine, airman needs to understand cyber and practice cyber defense as they simply go about their daily lives, both as civilians and on active duty. But I think it also means that we have to have a larger debate as a country about how we will meet the cyber threat. And one of the things we discussed on the panel was whether or not we should have a separate cyber service. Mm-hmm. General Petraeus and others have invited this conversation, and I invite it as well. I don't have a definitive answer because I think, frankly, we need to have this debate in Congress and before the American people to understand from the experts, the strategists, whether or not it makes sense. But I think it's a realistic enough possibility. In other words, it's a good enough idea that it really might be something worth investing in, that we should have that debate. We should have it in Congress, and we should have it before the American public.
Another theme you touched on, and it's close to our hearts on the at the foundation is the importance of partnerships and working with our allied and other partners in multinational efforts, alliances. Can you elaborate that on that a little bit and how you see that playing into U.S. national security policy?
Absolutely. We have significantly strengthened our national security both at home and around the globe by being a part of historic alliances like NATO. But the challenge is that NATO was built on a 1949 framework that in some parts is just not relevant to today. I'll give you a good example. 1949, the big threat that we were worried about were millions of Soviet troops, you know, coursing through the Fulda Gap, as we like to say, and into Western Europe. And the fact that we didn't have the troop presence in Western Europe to counter that essentially gave rise to NATO, to the mutual security guarantee, and even the role of nuclear weapons in the defense of NATO. The reality today is that Russia is attacking us on a daily basis, attacking NATO allies on a daily basis, and the United States through the internet, through their hybrid warfare techniques. And how does NATO respond? That's not part of the 1949 agreement. We don't know as NATO allies whether or not that should trigger the mutual security guarantee. And I think because we don't know that, because we haven't set it out and made a clear declaration on that, Russia is kind of walking all over us. Russia is not only able to successfully attack us through the internet, I think they now question whether the mutual security guarantee is serious for everything. And that's a real security threat to the United States and to our European allies. So we really need to rethink these alliances for a new world. There also may be opportunities to develop new ones. I think that we should be discussing a Pacific version of NATO, bringing together historically contentious allies like Japan and South Korea to unite in a more formal way to contain China and North Korea.
Do you think on the relationship about Asia during containment strategy, you know, during the Cold War, you saw countries like South Korea and Taiwan had similar GDPs as places like Ghana. But when you saw the commitment from the United States to contain Russia and Asia, you saw those GDPs go up. Do you think that there's possible partnerships in areas like, say, on the continent of Africa, for instance, in terms of terrorism, organized crime, and those with, you know, in those aspects to be able to form those new partnerships?
Absolutely. And the fact that China has moved in and is basically just taking control of Africa and we're not doing anything we're hardly doing anything, I should say, to stop it is all the more reason why we should be exploring these kinds of alliances. And one of the most successful aspects of NATO is that although formally a military alliance, it's essentially an economic alliance as well. And that's exactly the strategy that China is using effectively throughout Asia and now in Africa as well, and even in parts of Central and South America, right under our noses. Right. And we really do not have a strategy to counter it. We were the founders of this strategy. I mean, it was our plan. Marshall was not a Chinese general. Okay, he's an American statesman who pushed forward that plan. By the way, it's been so successful that it's easy to forget that it was highly controversial at the time and very difficult to get through the Congress. But it was absolutely brilliant. Right. We should have learned that lesson and be duplicating it today, not simply ceding that to China.
Let's take a quick break to talk about one of the Global Soft Foundation's corporate partners, PAE. PAE is a leading provider of enduring support for the essential missions of the U.S. government, its allied partners, and international organizations. With over 60 years of experience, PAE supports the execution of complex and critical missions by providing global logistics and stability operations, technical services, and national security solutions to customers around the world. PAE has a workforce of approximately 20,000 people in over 60 countries on all 7 continents and is headquartered in Arlington, Virginia. Thank you for being an awesome partner, PAE. Now let's get back to the congressman.
Are there other areas, other capabilities in the U.S. military that you would strengthen that would operate in this gray space, hybrid threat area, you know, whatever, contested space. There's lots of terms now for it. It used to be phase zero.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What are those capabilities you would strengthen?
Well, artificial intelligence is, I think, at the top of my list. Mm-hmm. China has made a commitment to be the world leader in artificial intelligence by 2030. They've put a massive amount of money behind that commitment, and we have done almost nothing in response. Mm-hmm. Our defense budget this year, if you look at all the different departments, not even actually even beyond DOD specifically, that are investing in AI capabilities, it equals about 1% of China's commitment over the next 10 years. So it is woefully inadequate. We need to have a response to that. There are a lot of other areas where this matters as well. And it's not just China, although that's the easiest and I think most important comparison. I think about the fact that when I was in Iraq, especially in the latter years, when the terrorist networks, Al-Qaeda and then ISIS to follow, were developing very significant and sophisticated online operations. You know, there were times where it felt like we were there on the ground fighting at the pointy tip of the spear, and the terrorists were defeating us on the internet. Mm-hmm. That should be reversed.
Mm-hmm. You talk about trade-offs and embracing technology, almost a third offset, investing in the right assets and the right capabilities. Do you think, as the Congress has the ability, even though sometimes our military generals and admirals, they know where they want to go in terms of capability, but because of constituents at home, certain activities and products don't get turned off. For instance, like maybe an M1 tank or an A-10 program, you know, just to maintain jobs. Do you think the Congress is ready to embrace that third offset at a chance of losing jobs in their district?
No. And I think that's a massive threat to our national security. Mm-hmm. And as a member of Congress, I'm embarrassed by that answer. I wish I could tell you, yes, we are ready and we're doing it. But the fact of the matter is that that we're not. Someone asked me on the trip over here when I was telling her about this panel. She said, this is actually a former attorney general from Massachusetts. She said, so what is the deal? Is it that you have a bunch of sort of old line generals and admirals in the U.S. military and the DOD who don't want to make these next generation investments? And I said, no, I think really the problem is in Congress. Mm-hmm. It's Congress that should be setting this strategy with our defense budget. And we're not. And I've got an early introduction to this when I was a freshman. And one of the first amendments I pursued on the Armed Services Committee was an amendment to defund the A-10. Mm-hmm. Now, it was necessary as an amendment because the proposed budget from the Republicans was to massively increase funding for the A-10, even though the Air Force did not want it. Right. Now, how often does a military service come to Congress and say, no, we actually don't want your money for
right?
But that's literally what was happening. By proposing this amendment to cut the A-10, I was on the side of the Air Force. I was on the side of DOD. The Republicans wouldn't let it happen. Right. And I'm sure it had a little bit to do with the fact that the closest congressional race in the entire country in 2014 mm-hmm. was in an Arizona district that contains the largest A-10 base in the world.
Right.
And the Republican candidate just happened to be an A-10 pilot. So it's a nice story, but the fact of the matter is that it's really dangerous for our national defense if that's how we're making these key decisions about investing for the next generation.
Thank you.
Before you go, I thought maybe you could share a little bit about why you're so passionate about encouraging veterans to run for office and serve. What inspired you? And I know you've had a lot of success in doing that, but what inspired you to take that on?
Well, I think it's important for people to know up front that I just simply wouldn't be here if not for my time in the Marines. I didn't grow up interested in politics. I didn't study it in school. I wasn't involved in campaigns. For me, it really took the Iraq War and being on the ground and seeing some of the failed consequences or the consequences of failed leadership in Washington to understand just how important politics is. And that's why I decided to get involved. That's why I ran for Congress. But when I was elected, I just figured, well, I don't have much of a political background. I'm just going to do a good job as a congressman and represent my district. And I worked hard, and I got awards for being an effective freshman and all that. When 2016 happened, I realized we need to just fundamentally change Congress. It's not enough just for me to do a good job myself. I need to work on getting better people, better leaders here. And that's what we achieved in 2018 in the midterms. Of the 40 seats Democrats flipped in the House to take back control, 21 of them were endorsed and supported by my Serve America organization, which was really founded to support service veterans or national service veterans. By the way, not just military veterans, but mm-hmm. Peace Corps, City Year, AmeriCorps
yeah,
veterans
public
as well.
Mm-hmm.
Public servants.
Yeah, right.
And we expanded a bit to just include publicly, public servant minded folks when we grew faster than we anticipated. But a further subset, 10 of the 40 seats we flipped were these veterans that we were heavily involved in their races. And I think what you'll see is they'll come to Congress and they'll be better leaders. They'll be more effective at doing the right thing for the country because they've had to do the right thing for the country before. They'll be willing to put people before politics and put the country before their political party.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
It's an honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Take care.
Soft Spot is brought to you by the Global Soft Foundation, a 501c3 based in Tampa, Florida. If you're new to us, you can find out more about the foundation at gsoft.org. That's Gulf Sierra October Foxtrot.org.